Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Adam Grant, welcome to my show. You're a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. It says on your Wikipedia page that you've been recognized as both the youngest tenured and most highly rated professor at the Wharton School, which is pretty amazing. This is actually the first time we've ever talked to each other. So this is, I feel like stuff, it just got real, you know?
Well, it's kind of amazing, Scott, because I feel like every time I read a post that you write, I have one of two reactions. One, this is brilliant. Two, oh my God, I wish I wrote that. And usually following both of those reactions is, if I had thought to write about this topic, you captured my views perfectly. So I feel like either we read a lot of the same stuff or we share a pretty similar set of values and worldviews.
Look, I really think that it's a combination of both. And I think, and by the way, I feel that way often when I read a lot of your stuff. I really do think it is that sharing of not just worldviews, but sharing of similar things. We're both like obviously curious people, and we're curious about a broad array of things and kind of getting at the as truth, getting at the truth of the matter as much as possible. But there's these reoccurring themes in my own life I've had over and over and over again. And I actually see a lot of these reoccurring themes in your life. Maybe we could psychoanalyze each other. Maybe this can be like a moment where we can like try to figure ourselves out for the first time.
That sounds dangerous.
It does. Maybe we shouldn't do that. But I feel like I can count, you know, I've noticed some similar threads that, that I'm like, and I'm not even going to like sugarcoat this. I'm literally obsessed with these topics. Like it's obsessed. I'm obsessed. success, creativity, human potential, talent, nice guys versus like do nice guys really finish last has been a reoccurring theme I've been interested in a long time and the intersection of all those things. So I think that there's maybe you know maybe there's maybe we're destined to dare I say be friends, because you wrote an interesting article about how like everyone says like they're friends with Adam Grant and you're like that's like kind of annoying to you.
All of a sudden, these, you know, complete strangers and bare acquaintances are saying, oh, my friend Scott Barry Kaufman. And you're like, who is this person? And I think it's so easy in the Facebook era to just have a very broad notion of what a friend means. But I still feel like a friend is somebody that, you know, sort of knows a lot of embarrassing things about me and vice versa, and that I could call without a scheduled conversation. And I think we need another category, right, to describe like the person who's between friend and acquaintance. And you know, if we work with them, we call them colleagues. But if we don't, there's no term in English to describe what these people are.
Well, you know, I think I'm more liberal about who I call my friends in the sense that if you're my like you could be my colleague, but if I really like you, then I'm fine call it, like saying you're my friend. Like I don't feel like you have to pass the criteria where you have to, you know, call me if you're going to jump off a ledge at like, you know, 2 in the morning. Like there's this like if I like you, I want to be friends. You know, it's like I have this like urge to be friends with you. You know, but.
And that may make you more extroverted than I am.
Okay, well, that's an interesting topic. Again, the introversion thing. We have a mutual. I'm scared to say friend now, colleague slash someone that we both like. May I say, Susan Cain, who wrote this amazing book on introversion, and quite frankly, I identify as an introvert after reading that book. Where do you put yourself in that all that space?
Yeah, I think I'm probably a sociable introvert. I really love people, but I feel sometimes like it's easy to get overstimulated, and I'm most myself when I'm reading or writing or analyzing data or, you know, talking to one person as opposed to sort of being the center of attention or hanging out in a crowd. Now, I realize being a professor and a public speaker is sort of an unusual set of career choices for somebody who's an introvert, but I actually find that, you know, it's a really nice way to sort of share ideas, but still have a chance to live the life of the mind. And I have always wondered, do other people experience it that way too? So is that also your take?
Yeah, I still don't fully understand myself. I would be lying if I said I did in terms of especially in the introversion extroversion dimension. I find that if I just go too much in one direction, I really do crave the other thing. And that just seems to be a general rule with me. Like, I need solitude, and I do feel mo I do that's an interesting way you phrased it. I do feel most myself when I'm like curled up in a bed reading something that I'm intellectually curious about. However, with that said, if I let's say that I was like in solitary confinement and I had a full like week where I was like locked up and I was forced for a full week to feel most myself, I would start hating myself. So I would crave
I
social.
think that's one of the myths that's
Yeah.
probably bothered both of us is like as introverts, we're still social creatures.
Yeah. That's right. Well, that's it. I mean, you just nailed it. Nailed it. Is that nailed it? That we're. I mean, you can still be an introvert and be a social creature. It really is that. How much do you need? Constantly need to. I wrote this article, and thank you. You retweeted me. I was like, awesome. Really, it is like the extroversion dimension of the Big Five. Really, is this need for social attention. This need for constant reward. The reward system, the dopamine system, is on high alert. And I have two cups of coffee, and I become an extrovert. I know scientifically, that doesn't mean I'm an extrovert full stop. It means I've taken artificial drugs that have increased my dopamine system, where I all of a sudden like rewards everywhere. I'm like, what's going on here? So anyway, let's focus for a second on your book. Can you just tell people a little bit what the difference is between a giver, a taker, a matcher, and a faker? Actually, that would make a cool song. That would make a really cool song now that I said all that, like a
It's
Bob
waiting to be
Dylan.
written.
Yeah.
The ideally with a better voice, but
Yeah.
I know the lyrics will be great if he does it. So for me, these are the major styles of interaction that you see in every culture and every industry that's ever been studied. And the takers are people who are always trying to get stuff from other people. They don't want to give anything back unless they have to. They're great social loafers, free riders, shirkers. The givers for me are the opposite. I think a lot of people, when they hear giver, they imagine a volunteer, a philanthropist. But for me, it's a much broader idea of just being the kind of person who enjoys helping others and often does it with no strings attached. So that could be sharing your knowledge, being a mentor, making introductions, or just showing up early or staying late to support other people. And most of us love this idea of being a giver, but we also know there are takers out there. So we tend to reserve giving for our families and our real friends. And then professionally, we choose this third style called matching. Matchers try to keep an even balance of give and take, quid pro quo. I'll do something for you if you do something for me. And the faker is basically usually the taker in disguise, masquerading as either a giver or a matcher to then be able to get things in return.
They're Machiavellian. The fakers are Machiavellian. Are you really good at can you tell when someone's a faker? Really, can you tell that really well?
I think that I would like to say that I do better than chance, but how much better than chance is an open question. I think, one of the tricky things is we all have moments of giving, taking, and matching.
That's
So
good.
your
That's a good
style is really
point.
just how you treat most of the people most of the time. And it's
Yeah.
very easy to get thrown off by somebody who's temporarily in a taking mindset because they're dealing with a zero-sum situation or a scarce resource, or they've been taken advantage of one too many times. And, it's one thing to say that person is operating like a taker. It's another to say they are a taker, right? And that's their default or dominant
Yeah.
approach to interacting with people. And I think the latter group is much easier to identify than the former, right? Like the people who are taking in most of their interactions, tend to leak lots of cues and they're not that great at faking. So it's much easier to spot them.
No, absolutely. There was this really, this New York Times did a profile on you, and it was really interesting because I resonated. Again, maybe that's why we have similar research interests. There's other aspects, maybe deeper aspects that are similar. And yeah, I think it's interesting. There's this they said that your need to give sometimes reaches like a compulsion sort of aspect. And I like if this is too personal, totally like tell me and I'll just like cut it. But I do think you're trying to understand this stuff. Like I feel that myself sometimes. I actually, I mean, I think that like. I'm scared to death of saying I'm a giver now because I'm so like self-conscious of like saying anything that can strategically be used to think that I'm something else. Like super self-conscious talking to you. But I think that like, I think it is fair to say that like I almost like I feel a draw like it's very, let's put it this way. It's very hard for me, no matter if it, who it is, what it is, if they request something, it's very hard for me to say no. And whatever that makes me, whatever, I'm not putting any labels on myself. Can you relate to that at all?
Yeah, I think, it's funny. I used to think that that was primarily like from, the motivation to be a giver. And the more time I spent researching this topic and writing about it and talking about it, the more I've become convinced that it's actually like the interplay of two different sets of tendencies, right? Like one
Okay.
is values around helping others and wanting to be more of a giver than a taker or a matcher, which usually means you're going to feel really guilty if you don't help. And you worry about letting other people down and what kind of ways you could have helped them that you've failed to follow through on. But the other part of it is one of the big five personality traits that you're well familiar with, agreeableness.
Yeah.
And personality psychologists used to lump together being agreeable with a giver, and they said like, look, being nice, friendly, welcoming, polite is also usually correlated with being compassionate and helpful and other oriented. And the more data I gather, the more I find that these characteristics tend to really separate. And like agreeableness primarily is about being nice and polite, and it makes it really hard to say no. But there are a lot of disagreeable givers out there, right, who on the surface are gruff and tough, but tend to have other people's best interests at heart. Bob Sutton at Stanford likes to call them porcupines with a heart of gold. And I think that if you were one of those people, you wouldn't feel this compulsion to give, right? You'd want to do what's helpful to other people, but a lot of the time that would be saying no or giving them incredibly difficult feedback, and it would be much easier probably to set boundaries.
I'm wondering, I'm surprised you didn't mention neuroticism, because I think there's an interaction there between neuroticism and agreeableness maybe in this situation, is that, and also the big six factor, which I'm going to add, we'll call Jewish guilt, which is that's like the sixth factor of the big five, which is only people who speak Yiddish can get access to that factor. But where does Jewish guilt come into being a giver? You don't talk about that in your book at all.
I don't. I think you could say Jewish guilt or Catholic guilt or both.
Yeah, or
I
Italian,
think
right?
that,
Absolutely. Yeah.
obviously there are lots of cultures and belief systems known for their emphasis on guilt. And
Absolutely,
I don't know,
yeah.
my read of the evidence is that guilt is one of the most powerful pro-social emotions. It's the sort of, especially when growing up, the constant experience of having disappointed other people and, fallen short of some standard or expectation, leads to this, at least in Roy Baumeister's terms, it has this like anticipatory effect where then the next time you're potentially going to harm someone or let them down, you worry about feeling guilty again, and that leads you to take all these actions preventatively to try to do the right thing or to do good. And then that sort of becomes self-sustaining. And I think the guilt becomes more and more rare, and you just get in the habit of helping as something that sort of like reinforces almost this reward system.
I mean, this is it, all these issues are so. When I read your book, I thought of so many different domains that I'm trying to think how these things apply to. You don't talk too much about the mating domain, but there's this old question, like, do nice guys finish last in terms of relationships or in terms of sexual partners or everything like that? And I think it is a way of reconciling that is you do show quite clearly in your book that a lot of some takers can seem at first glance as very popular and attractive, but you do find,
But you think
8 months in, 9 months in,
then
you start seeing them for who they are, and all the shit hits the fan, so to speak, and you see that in terms of success. But that it seems to apply to almost anything, right? Applies to relationships too, right?
Yeah, I think it does. As you know, I was really intrigued by this recent paper of Pat Barclay's where, more or less he found that like women are more likely to say yes to a first date with a taker, but they're more likely to want a relationship and a marriage with a giver.
There you go.
And I think almost the dating marriage sort of contrast tracks beautifully with what we see in the workplace. It's very easy for people to be drawn in by the confidence that takers exude. And we tend to mistake that a lot of times for competence. But as our, I guess we should say, mutual friend Susan Cain is fond of saying, yeah, there's zero correlation between who's the best talker and who has the best ideas. And if you were to translate that into the domain of romantic relationships, I would say, you know, there's zero correlation between who's the most confident date and who's actually the best partner. And, you know, I think that most people, generally speaking, want to marry and be with a giver. So that tends to, I think, mirror pretty nicely the organizational data.
Right. So you absolutely can be a good human being, a decent human being, and reach your goals in life. What is the difference, Adam, between a giver and a doormat?
I'd like to think that one sits on your front porch and the other is a person, but the givers who become doormats, right, are the people who say yes to all the people all the time with all the requests. And yeah. I think that what happens with a lot of givers is they just become more thoughtful over time about saying, you know, if somebody has a history or a reputation of being a really selfish taker, then I'm going to be more cautious, right? It may mean I help that person less. It could involve, you know, just trying not to be too interdependent with them, or it might mean if you help them, you expect some kind of reciprocity, either they pay it back or pay it forward so that you hold them accountable. And the doormats are the people who just allow takers to, you know, to basically exploit them. There are also, I think, though, people who just try to help in too many different ways and at too many different times, as opposed to saying, look, I need to be vigilant about helping in ways that align with my interest and expertise so that it's enjoyable and energizing and so that I'm actually contributing something of unique value to other people and that I've protected time to get my own work done. And I think if you're, you know, a little bit more thoughtful as a giver about who you help, how you help, and when you help, it becomes a lot easier to not get taken advantage of and to make sure that you're contributing in ways that are efficient and don't sacrifice your own priorities.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think that it's a message that we're not really taught as children growing up. At least the culture, you know, I lived in, there really was this emphasis that, you know, we're told, like, be a man, whatever that means, right? Or like, you know, like, don't be a sissy, as though being a sissy is like being nice, right? Or being giving. I mean, I do wonder, I really, really do like your message. And I try to think of like public policy implications. I'm sure you've given this a lot of thought. Let's just start with school. What could be some ways we could structure environments so that we reward givers? I mean, we reward high standardized test scores. We reward, that's basically all we reward in an educational context is high standardized test scores. And we don't even reward like things like, you know, Angela Duckworth and I just wrote a paper recently. We argue that schools should value effort, the value of effort more, you know, value a growth mindset more. But here's something else that your research shows. We should probably value givers more. That should be part of something that we reward, right? What do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I certainly love that idea. So one way that I've thought about this from time to time is Elliot Aronson's classic Jigsaw Classroom, you know, which
I love that.
Back in the early 1970s was designed to try to fight prejudice and, you know, get children coming from different racial and ethnic backgrounds to better respect and understand each other. And I think the model there, though, is a really clever way of valuing giving, because what you do is in an elementary school, you might divide like a group of four to do a book report on Eleanor Roosevelt's life. And, you know, each child is responsible for a different portion of her life. And so they're completely interdependent. And the way that basically the grade gets allocated to the group is, has everybody made the biggest possible contribution toward the group's goals? I think that as children get older and we start to see more sort of high stakes testing, more forced grading curves, I think we unfortunately end up sort of putting students in situations where they feel like they have to outdo their peers in order to succeed. Right? There's a limited number of spots in, you know, a particular college that they want to go to, or there's a limited number of A's in a class. And, you know, I think that's teaching them the wrong message about life. Most of life is not zero sum. You can succeed in ways that help others. And so I'll tell you, I've tried an experiment in my classroom recently on this where I want to encourage students to study together. You know, we don't have a forced grading curve in it of any kind, so every student basically gets the grade that he or she earns. But I want to encourage them to help each other to learn the material. And I decided a small way of doing that was I have some really difficult multiple choice questions on my undergraduate final exam. So they can pick the one question they think is hardest that they don't know the answer to and write down the name of someone else in the class they think knows it. And if that person gets it right, they get that person's points too. And it was really fun when I experimented with this a year ago to see a bunch of students in class come together and basically like figure out who knows what and each become experts in different domains.
That's a test of like metacognition in a way. Other metacognition.
Yeah, maybe transactive memory too. You know, like memory of who knows what. But I think it really rewarded students who not only had certain knowledge, but were willing to share it and sort of make it known to other people that, you know, this was an area that they had studied really hard or that they had taken a deep interest in, and they were sort of in a position to let others benefit from that. And I would love to see more mechanisms encourage that kind of giving and reward it.
So you talked about zero sum. You talked in the book a little bit about how credit is not a zero sum game, giving or taking credit. And takers do view it as a zero sum game. Is that right?
I think more often than not, I think a lot of takers do look at credit as a zero-sum game, right? The more I want to win, the more you have to lose. And I had an experience with this when I was in grad school. I was working on my first major paper. I'd finished the equivalent of a master's thesis, and I had a bunch of undergrads who helped me with it. They were, you know, great in helping to formulate the ideas and, you know, kind of collect some of the data. And I turned in the first draft of the paper to one of my advisors, and, you know, it basically had my name and five undergraduate students' names on it, and I was told to take them off. And, you know, the thought was, well, you know, undergraduates are just research assistants, and, you know, we may credit them in the acknowledgments, but we don't make them co-authors of our papers. And also, you know, that may detract from, you know, your identity as an independent scholar. And I said, listen, first of all, these students absolutely earned authorship. Second of all, you know, there's no way in which having them on the paper detracts from my contribution, right? I'm still the lead on the paper, right? I'm the first author, and I don't think it takes anything away from me to bring them on as authors 2 through 6. And I basically, probably against my better judgment, ignored my advisor's suggestion and ended up publishing the paper that way. And it's one of the decisions that I feel the best about looking back, because one of those students ended up going to a PhD program and is now a professor. Awesome. It's really nice to have an influential paper to start grad school with. You know, and several others, you know, it's become sort of interesting conversation pieces as they've interviewed for jobs, and it's a great opportunity to, you know, to get their ideas out there a little bit too. So I think that we should all probably stop and think when we ask, you know, if I give somebody else credit, is that going to steal the spotlight from me, and try to figure out ways that everybody can shine.
Yeah, and I really like that. And we can really learn from people's mistakes as well. You write very eloquently about a lot of specific examples. What was Jonas Salk's big mistake?
You know, this is funny, because I was looking for interesting examples of givers who had shared credit generously. And I started reading about Jonas Salk, thinking of, you know, the guy who created the polio vaccine. I remembered reading some time ago that, you know, he was interviewed by a journalist and asked, was he going to patent it? And he basically said, you know, you wouldn't patent the sun. Yeah, this is for the benefit of humanity.
Right.
And as I read more deeply, I found out a few things. One, it was not possible to patent the polio vaccine. I didn't meet the patent criteria. Two, it turned out that Salk, at least in the credit domain, was a pretty massive taker. So he, you know, created this vaccine, building directly off of the Nobel Prize winning work of three scientists that had happened a few years earlier. And then he had a whole team of people in his lab that were absolutely essential to getting the vaccine created. And when he gave his major award and announcement speech, he never even acknowledged the names of the people who had, you know, helped him and made the polio vaccine possible. And then he spent more or less the next few decades of his life just ignoring them and never gave them public credit. And he got, you know, shunned by a whole academy of sciences. He never really got the scientific recognition he felt he deserved. And, you know, there's some debate about whether that's because, in part, you know, his contribution was really applied and the basic science had already been done. But it seems that some of that was because, you know, he violated the scientific norms of sort of honoring all the people who made fundamental contributions to his work. And I think it's very telling that his son, who's a physician, ended up finally at an anniversary after his death of the polio vaccine, ended up acknowledging finally the contributions of the people who had helped.
Good for it. Go him. The son.
Yeah, I feel like he set the record straight in some ways. Maybe too little, too late. But,
yeah, but he definitely did the right thing. And then you look at, I think it's very equally as telling, are other opposite ends of that spectrum, like people like George, is it Mayer or Meyer?
George Meyer.
Meyer, that you talk about, that many people don't automatically associate with The Simpsons, yet he does, I don't know, you could say deserves more credits than he's taken.
Yeah, I think, you know, George Meyer was such an interesting example for me because, you know, you don't expect to see that many givers in Hollywood. And actually, my editor, Kevin Doughton, had been in comedy before he joined the publishing industry. And as we were working through a chapter, he said, you know, this reminded me a lot of George Meyer, this great Simpsons writer that everybody says is the funniest person in comedy. And, you know, almost nobody's ever heard of him. You know, you might be somebody to profile. So, you know, we started reading him. Kevin helped get me introduced to him. And it turned out that, you know, although he'd contributed over 300 Simpsons episodes and many described him as the funniest person and the heart of the show, he'd only ever gotten writing credit on 12 of the episodes. What happened was at some point he realized the best thing for everyone, himself included, was for the show to be as good as possible. And, you know, what he was able to do probably the most effectively was, you know, give people feedback, make their scripts better, and, you know, not necessarily worry about who got the credit at the end of the day. And I think the nice upshot of that was even after he left the show, everybody wanted him back and they talked him into returning. And then when they made the big movie, he was one of the people that everybody wanted to have around, which really goes back to our opening conversation that, yeah, you know, George is so funny that it would be very easy for everyone else to be jealous of him and threatened by him. But, you know, he's a guy who made everybody else funnier. And so you want him in the room, right? Because he's using his talents for the best interest of the group. And he's somebody who makes you more successful. And so instead of gunning for him, you end up rooting for him.
Absolutely. You know, I've spent enough in my whole life, I've spent a good amount of deal of time around jerks, I would say. Do you say why?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, I could say starting from my youth, I don't want to like turn this conversation to me all of a sudden, but I was bullied a lot. Let's just, you know, just say, because of I was in special education. So I was bullied all the time and spending a lot of time around these people. I'm fascinated by them. Because I want to know something in particular that fascinates me. So many of them seem to lack fundamental insight, self-insight into their actions on others. And that's one thing I noticed so much that it wouldn't even, like, for instance, with Salk, it seemed like it didn't even dawn on him that it couldn't even dawn on, it wouldn't even dawn on me to not even have that not dawn on me to acknowledge other people that have helped me. Do you know? It's probably the same with you, but around like authentic, you know, like people who are just ruthless, they don't even seem to be aware or is it that they don't care? That I don't understand. I don't know if it's they're aware and don't care or they're not aware, but I'm very interested in getting the truth of that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you definitely see both varieties. Yeah. You know, like Salk at some point could not plead ignorance because he had been directly confronted by several of these colleagues and right. He more or less blew them off. And it became fairly apparent that, you know, either he didn't care or he didn't care enough. I think that, you know, it's interesting, you know, when you look at this sort of through the lens of give and take, there are a lot of takers who think that they're givers. And that I find deeply disturbing.
Me too.
You know, a lot of takers are narcissistic and they tend to have sort of inflated egos and that may extend to, you know, how they judge themselves, even in the domain of concern for others. But I think there is an information discrepancy problem that, you know, you just there's some research on this dating back to the 1970s that you just know more about your own contributions than you do other people's. Right. You like Scott, you have access to every act of giving you have ever done.
Right.
Whereas when you're judging somebody else, you only have a small fraction of their moments of generosity. And so I think it is easy to overestimate how much of that we do. And one of the easiest ways to, you know, get the takers to be less selfish or more self-aware, you know, to also take the jerks and get them to realize their impact on others is to try to help them better sort of calibrate, you know, how much damage are they causing to others and how much good are they doing relative to other people they may interact with. And I think it's hard to get that feedback.
Well, absolutely. So this is a good time to ask practical, what are some signs that you're a taker? Like, because I think, like, you know, that's helpful for people to, like you said, it's, you're never always a giver, always a taker. I mean, there are obviously times where I'm being a taker, times when you're being a taker, because, right, we're not perfect human beings. But I think there's a great value in knowing some signs so that we can be more self-aware. I think we could all use to be more self-aware, probably, of when we think we may be giving, but we're actually taking, for instance. Do you have any specific signs you can talk about?
Sure. You know, I have to say, I wrote a tongue-in-cheek post about this some months ago, about the top 10 signs that you might be a taker.
And what are some of them?
I'd actually gathered like a whole list of funny comments from readers over the previous year. Yeah. And, you know, I had a whole list of my own. And so I think some of my favorite ones were when a child draws a picture of you, it bears a passing resemblance to either a snake or a weasel.
Oh,
I think that's a good test. You know, you're in your 30s. You're still bragging about your SAT score. That's a problem.
I could check that one off my list because I didn't do well in my SATs.
Yeah, and then my favorite one was that after reading The Giving Tree, you feel like the tree got exactly what it deserved.
Oh, my gosh.
No, but I mean, I think, look, I think the signs that you might be a taker, one would just be that you find that people have a hard time trusting you. That's sort of a telltale signal that something's up. A second is that you feel like other people never fully value your contributions, and you're constantly going around underappreciated. Another interesting sign is sort of this feedback that you might occasionally pick up that people think you carry around a sense of entitlement.
So can I stop you right there? Because everything you just mentioned, I don't know if you read an article I wrote on covert narcissism a couple years ago. So everything you just mentioned is part of the questionnaire for covert narcissism. Maybe covert narcissists are fakers.
I think a lot of them are. You know, I think there are some covert narcissists who are, you might call them benevolent narcissists.
Yeah.
You know, and like the way that they sort of build themselves up is to be the most helpful person. I got an email from somebody last year who I guess had read my book and said, "My goal is to become the greatest giver. How do I do that?"
Wow.
And my first response was, abandon that goal. It's not about being the greatest giver. It's about being more of a giver, or, you know, trying to express these values.
That person wants to win.
Yes.
They see giving as a competition.
I'm going to one up you and become even more helpful and generous than you are, right?
But that's hilarious.
I think that you're right. Most covert narcissists probably are fakers.
Cool. So I didn't mean to cut you off. You can keep going, but I wanted to capture that moment that,
No, I mean, I think, you know, the other signs are not surprising, right? So spending a massive amount of time sort of carefully crafting your image to put your best foot forward, you know, going out of your way to document all the important people that you are photographed with randomly. I think a lot of the signs of insecurity often sort of predict taking behavior pretty regularly.
Right. So taking, I want to be very clear, taking it can be a trait, and you often talk about it as a trait, but it also is a state, and it's something that I think there's value for all of us, no matter who we are, to recognize these things in ourselves. You know, like if we see ourselves posting too many pictures on Facebook of ourselves with others, that it doesn't mean like we're immediately a horrible, horrible person, but it might be information for us that, you know what, maybe I am feeling particularly insecure these days. You know, we all go through those moments, you know, where we're like, but it could be, there could be information there that you've been in this state for too long. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that would be fascinating. And, you know, it makes me think that This would be a really interesting sort of built-in feedback mechanism for social media,
Oh,
right? That
absolutely.
your post could be analyzed for exactly that kind of information. And yeah, I think it's the kind of thing that in real life you get from your close friends occasionally, right? Like I think a lot of people have gone through the experience of having a friend say, you know, like this is too much about you, or I feel like, you know, this relationship is out of balance. And I think
Absolutely.
a lot of people actually overcorrect for that, and they decide, you know, I want to be on the giving end of every exchange. I never want to be a taker. And I think that, you know, that often stops them from asking for help or for, you know, from reaching out when they really need it. And I think there's a huge difference between taking and receiving. You know, you can be a taker, which is basically using somebody else solely for personal gain. And I obviously don't have a lot of patience or respect for that, but you know, receiving is to me just saying, look, there's somebody who can benefit me more than it costs them. And I will accept that contribution and then try to maintain a willingness to pay it back or pay it forward. And I think we probably all need to be better at receiving and do less taking.
I would completely agree. So a lot of this message is that you argue that our success depends more on others than we realize, and that things like reputation matters. That a lot of jerks, it really does come back to you in a karma sort of way. So I want to ask, because you wrote an interesting article relevant to this reputation idea. I want to ask you, who do you think will leave a greater legacy, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates?
I picked up on this from an interview that Malcolm Gladwell did. He said that if he were going to bet in 50 years, Apple will still be around and Microsoft won't, but Steve Jobs would be forgotten and Bill Gates would be remembered. And I found that to be a really interesting juxtaposition. And you know, I remember you know, Malcolm saying basically that he thought that legacies were about helping others and giving primarily. Right? They're not about what you achieve; they're about how your achievements contribute to the world. And you know, I think that unfortunately, a lot of Jobs's technological and design achievements are going to be, you know, we're going to evolve past them. Whereas the Gates legacy is one of you know, essentially potentially solving problems of access to information, poverty, health disparities, and I think that probably in the long run is more memorable and something that general sort of members in society find to be more meaningful. So
Oh, wow.
I guess I'm going to vote with Malcolm and say I think Gates will be more remembered than Jobs.
Oh, wow. So 50 years from now, we'll be holding our iPad 50 and we'll be daydreaming of Bill Gates.
It's entirely possible.
Is what you're saying. That's really interesting. Now, you've wrote an article, by the way, about Malcolm Gladwell. I saw an interview you did with him. I think it was at Penn. He came over, and that was really an interesting interview. And you wrote an article defending him, because a lot of my scientist colleagues are very angry with him. Think that he fundamentally misrepresents science. And I imagine, and you defended him, and I thought that was really interesting. And I try to keep an open mind about all this stuff. And I'd love to hear some of what your thoughts on the value of that kind of science writing.
Well, I think you know, I think the thing that Malcolm has done for the world is he's made social science cool. And you know, I think social science is one of the most useful things that exists in the world, and a lot of it just sits in academic journals collecting dust. And he's made it not only acceptable but interesting to talk about. He's made it important for organizations to care about and really understand. And, you know, he's opened the door for all of us who write these kinds of books and blog posts and articles to have a genre to contribute to. It's about big ideas and sort of the synthesis of compelling stories and important studies. I have never, ever read a book that's by a scientist that does not include some biases.
Of
I think
course, of course.
it's impossible to go in with a blank slate. And, you know, I think that people who accuse Malcolm Gladwell of cherry picking, we all cherry pick, right? Where the job of an author is to make an argument and challenge people's assumptions, not to represent, you know, the whole and unadulterated truth, in my opinion. And I think that, you know, you have to oversimplify, you have to miss out on important nuances if you're going to translate something that's fairly complex for experts in a domain to debate for, you know, sort of a broad audience of readers with lots of different perspectives and different kinds of knowledge available. And, you know, I think there are a lot of sour grapes out there about, you know, people wanting to put Malcolm Gladwell out of business and it should be the real scientists writing science books. But, you know, without really brilliant storytellers who love science, like Malcolm playing the translation role, we don't exist as public intellectuals or thought leaders or anything else that our colleagues aspire to be.
So I agree with a lot of that, and I don't, you know, we don't need to get into a great discussion over this, but I agree with a lot of that. But I don't know if I would go so far to say that without him in particular, there's like no one could fulfill that role in a more nuanced way, in a more holistic, taking different perspectives way that does the job equally as well. That I don't know, so I don't know if I would go so far as agree with that specific statement that the whole field needs specifically him. But I think that, I think there's a lot of value in what you're saying, and I agree with an awful lot of it. And I do feel a great sense of like, indebtedness to, him for paving the way on that. So you wrote an article on, called Emotional Intelligence is Overrated. And this is another topic of mutual interest of ours. I have to say, that I was surprised about that article because it almost seems contradictory to your whole mission. So, you know, it's all about – we talk about cherry picking, right? And it's all about framing. So in that article, you frame it as sort of like, you know, look – It matters what dependent measure we're talking about, but I looked at this dependent measure and IQ was the best predictor. But then you titled the thing Emotional Intelligence Overrated. Now, so if I was thinking like if I was Adam Grant and I'm staying consistent to all my values and everything I wrote in my book, I would have titled it being a giver is underrated in XYZ context. Do you see what I'm saying? So I was confused, even though I agree, I know the findings are really, really interesting and that IQ in certain contexts where you don't need to manage interpersonal relationships, IQ is the better predictor. But it seems like your broader point wouldn't be the kind of person that would try to like say something like, oh, well, like niceness is overrated, you know, like you of all people. So anyway, I've been dying to ask you that question. Thanks for letting me ask you that, by the way.
It's interesting. I think, first of all, I think that social science really thrives on debate, right? That the controversy moves us forward. And I think that every once in a while, when I see cult-like devotion to a topic where the amount of, let's say, fervor for it far exceeds what the actual evidence says, I feel like I have a responsibility as a social scientist to say, let's take a step back. Let's look at what available data are and make sure that we're spending our time and our money in organizations, right? Whether we're doing emotional intelligence training or doing hiring on it effectively and wisely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of misconceptions out there about what emotional intelligence is. And this is actually why, I think a lot of readers misinterpreted the article to begin with. You know, I laid out, I think there's widespread consensus among, you know, all the psychologists who study this topic from, you know, Peter Salovey, who's now the president of Yale, to many of the other scholars in the domain, that emotional intelligence as originally defined and studied is about the skills you have in recognizing emotions, knowing what causes them and managing them. And, you know, it's not being nice. It's not social skills. It's not self-awareness. It's not empathy. It's a much narrower set of abilities that depend on basically knowledge and strategies for applying emotion to everyday life. And it turns out that at least if you measure job performance, it's not nearly as important as most people think it is. And I feel like that's a conversation that needs to be had because I would rather see people, frankly, invest in how do I get better at helping other people than how do I get better at reading other people's emotions? Mm. I would rather see them, you know, focus their time and energy on how do I learn about my employees' goals and what they want, if you're a manager, you know, how they want to develop and what skills they want to learn, than how do I figure out what made my employee angry today? Right. And I think that the I think we've overcorrected, right? We used to have sort of an IQ heavy bias. We were too cognitive, and I think that now actually emotional intelligence gets way overemphasized relative to the degree that these other factors matter.
Well, look, this is something I like about you. So you're the kind of person that You want to have integrity, and you don't want to. You're the type of person that if the pendulum swung too much in the direction of your ideas, that you would want to rebel against that.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I want to write my
I feel
next.
the same way. Sorry, what are you gonna
I
say?
want to write the next book about. It's going to be called "Take and Take: Why Selfish Bastards Succeed."
So that's funny you said that because I feel the same way. I wrote this book called Ungifted where I talk about, why we've overvalued IQ as the best indicator of human potential. Yet I've seen this big fad everywhere where for every marketing, it's a marketing ploy where everything you want to sell, you have to say as your subtitle why it's better than IQ. Daniel Goleman's book sold so many copies because his subtitle said why emotional intelligence is better than IQ. I actually do. Personally, I feel this. I want to rebel too. I actually am thinking about writing a book on why IQ matters.
Wow.
People would be like, why? Like,
Who are
what?
you? What happened to your entire ideology?
Because I think the truth is everything. The truth is that IQ matters. The truth is that the truth is that it matters. The only truth is probably that we shouldn't put anything on such a pedestal that we ignore everything else. Maybe that's the only truth.
I wholeheartedly agree with that, and I think that actually that impulse to rebel against your own ideas, I feel like that's what separates the scholars from the fundamentalists.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I remember Gary Marx is this great sociologist. As far as I know, no relation to Karl Marx, but Gary Marx once wrote that the difference between a scholar and a fundamentalist is that a scholar asks questions and a fundamentalist gives answers.
Oh, that's exactly
I
right.
mean, like to me, that sums up what we're supposed to be doing as social scientists, and it also suggests that we should be updating our beliefs over time, right? Like, maybe I was wrong. Maybe givers aren't as successful as I thought they were, and I had a bunch of data that told a good story. I don't think that's true at the moment, but it could be true. And if it were, I would, update my perspective, and I feel like that doesn't happen enough.
No, I agree. It doesn't. I want to end this interview with some sort of practical takeaway for listeners who are givers, but they don't. They're tired. You talk in the book about being an exhaust, being getting exhausted, being a giver and needing to protect that. Something I can completely relate to. It's compassion fatigue. I think some in the helping professions they call it. Are there some practical advices, things, ways to say no? Now you framed it as ways to say no without hurting your image, but also I would say like ways of saying no and still being a good, decent human being.
Yeah, I think that, I used to have a much harder time saying no. And as you know, when you start to get a larger and larger number of requests, you
Yes.
don't have a choice at some point. What I've come to realize is that saying no frees you up to say yes when it matters most. And, each time I get an opportunity, I try to look at that and say, okay, is this going to compromise my ability to help the people who I care most about or who need it the most? And where I can, contribute in the most unique ways. And I think that makes it a lot easier to say instead of no, right? Like here are my major priorities and the ways that I like to contribute. If I can help you in one of these ways, let's talk. So the biggest takeaway for me from the interviews I did was the idea of a 5-minute favor from the serial entrepreneur Adam Rifkin, who said, what you want to do basically is find, more or less small ways of adding large value to other people's lives. And what I think is brilliant about this idea is that if you are a giver already and you're exhausted or overextended, if you can try to reduce the cost of your giving, right? Think about instead of, spending an hour with every person who reaches out to you, are there other people who have the same expertise that you've helped in the past? Can you make the introduction there? And maybe connect them, or in a lot of cases, I've worked with entrepreneurs who are like constantly asked, how do I start a business? How do I think about finding a co-founder? How do I raise funds? And you have a bunch of those one-on-one conversations. Well, why not have a Google Hangout once a week, where you bring all those people together and you answer all their questions at once, and you've begun building a support network where they can help each other. That's like a scaled-up 5-minute favor, but I think we all need to think about managing the cost of our giving and doing it more efficient ways. But what I also love about the 5-minute favor is that if you are a taker or a matcher, this is the easiest way to get started with helping others, right? To say you don't have to become Mother Teresa or Gandhi, you don't have to do Herculean acts of sacrifice. Just look for, these little ways that you can make other people's lives a tiny bit better. You know, whether that's recognizing other people who do a great job by writing a thank you note to their boss, whether that's making an introduction or going out of your way to give a tiny little bit of feedback. I think that, you know, oftentimes we can add more value in 5 minutes than we think.
I love it. What a great way to end this interview. Thank you so much for chatting with Adam and for being so generous with your time.
No, thank you, Scott. Pleasure to chat.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.